Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly, your, and it is just for you, latest telegram from the stalls. And this weekly we'll be almost entirely up in the air as we scan the sky in search of the secrets that Grugru, the common crane, once shared with humanity. And still with necks craned, this stuff is basically writing itself, we're in Cabra exploring the communicative promises of aerial circus. But first, we're off to Tatooine. Cork-born artist George Bolster has spent time over the last few years observing the search for extraterrestrial life, working with the scientists at SETI in California as they scan the skies for signals from distant civilizations, signs spilling towards us across the frantic, noisy expanse of space. But is there anybody out there? Bolster's current exhibition at Sirius Art Center in Cove, Tatooine, Sci-Fi Becoming Reality, imagines via a drifting room-sized mobile or a panoramic tapestry that the answer is yes, because just maybe that's how the answer becomes yes.
I think the human brain works on intuition, and I think so much of that is thwarted by conditioning. My name is George Bolster. I'm an Irish artist, born in Cork. I am based in New York, and I have worked predominantly with issues related to science and art, especially those related to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and the research of NASA Kepler scientists over the last 4 years. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Essentially, they use oral and optical search devices, so that technically means that they're looking for visual artificial signals that occur outside the bandwidth of nature, and also radio signals that occur outside the bandwidth of nature. So essentially, they're looking for artificially made signals like the ones produced by Earth-based radio stations that have been going out into space since the dawn of radio. Nothing has been found as yet in terms of an intelligent signal that could come from another civilization. According to the astronomer Jill Tarter, the search so far has been comparable to taking a glass of water out of the ocean. That gives you an idea of how much exploration there is to do. It's a massive search, and it is one of the most exciting explorations of our time. When you arrive at the Allen Telescope Array, I mean, firstly, it's Northern California. You're driving out from San Francisco to almost 8 hours of driving through kind of dirt roads or forests, and then it becomes much more arid, and it's almost like a Nevada-type landscape. And so within this kind of somewhere between the desert and a forest is the Allen Telescope Array. And so you arrive at a kind of a small little forest area, and then you're taken to the scientific housing where everyone stays, and then you walk the rest of the way down this road because they prefer not to have interference. And there is so much radio now, or so much competing radio signals, that you have to try and find places that are somehow protected from receiving them. Suddenly you see these massive dishes everywhere. They're a gigantic scale, and they're moving as they search for different signals from planets that are within the Goldilocks zone. And the Goldilocks zone means that they're close enough to their sun or star to sustain life. I've been working with a lot of different scientists, but one of the scientists I was working with, Laurence Doyle, he found a planet named Kepler-16b, which is the scientific reference for the planet. It was a circumbinary planet, which means that it orbits two suns. Until that point, scientists thought this was a physical impossibility. And so upon finding this planet that orbited two suns, he contacted George Lucas to ask if they could call the planet after the home planet of Luke Skywalker from Star Wars. And so you have this planet, which is now called Tatooine, after the circumbinary planet that existed fictionally in Star Wars, which has now been proved to be a factual planet that really exists. It's a very interesting idea that so much of science fiction is continually coming to pass. So the actual piece itself is this room within a room. So it's a circular 9 foot tall panoramic image depicting Hat Creek and the radio telescopes at Allen Telescope Array. And so I was interested in the idea of making Kepler-16b this site of another intelligent life form searching for us through the same technology. So you have this massive panoramic vision of what it would be like on Kepler-16b. And because Kepler-16b has two suns, it has two rainbows whenever it rains.
And they crisscross as well.
They would crisscross.
The surprising thing about the way you've depicted it is the technique. We could almost imagine that this would be rendered in a VR experience, what life on Tatooine would be like. And you've taken the opposite direction.
I have, but it's deceptive in that I was looking at the idea of the founding of digital images and digital imagery, and then also the internet or the transference of images. In this piece, you have a reference to that through binary code. So it looks like tapestry, but essentially it's Jacquard, and it is Jacquard was the first industrial loom to use a computerized system. And so it used this card system that Turing looked at to decipher the Nazi codes during the Second World War. So I was interested in this appearance of something that has been with us since the invention of the loom, which is tapestry, and then also it having this discrete history of being incredibly important as the machine to not only make digital images, but found the kind of systems that we use today for everything.
George Bolster there, and his Tatooine sci-fi becoming reality is at Sirius Arts Centre in Cove until November 2nd. The reintroduction of long-lost species to a space can provoke feelings of both excitement and fear. Just try searching Wolves Ireland Reintroduction and Madness. And it's not just wolves. Even birds have their haters and their haze of rumours. But where does rational fear end and epigenetic aversion begin? What place does storytelling play in all this? Lorcan O'Toole has some form welcoming back native species to the island with the Golden Eagle Trust. He's been trying to understand some of the hidden reasons, cultural and occasionally mythological, that explain why we've been glad to see the back of some species. Áine Gallagher went to meet Lorcan in Glenveagh National Park in County Donegal.
At least that far away from them, so there's no danger at all. It's made to be enjoyed. It's here to be enjoyed. Right? Good luck to you.
Right.
We're in the main valley itself, at the end of Loch Fay. We're opposite the waterfall. Ireland is a little bit unique in that we're on the edge of another island, which is on the edge of the continent. So when species become extinct, they find it more difficult to recolonize naturally. Lorcan O'Toole. The General Manager of the Golden Eagle Trust. I've been working here in Donegal for 20 years when we started the Golden Eagle Reintroduction Programme. We brought wild birds in from Scotland, from wild nests in Scotland under licence, and we released them here in Glenveagh National Park. We did that for 12 years and they started to nest and breed in 2007. and they're still breeding, and hopefully in due course they'll increase in Donegal and reoccupy some of their former sites.
How far have the eagles travelled within Ireland?
We've had confirmed sightings down in Kerry and over in the Mourne Mountains. One or two of our birds from here have been seen in Scotland. We know that because all the birds we released, we put small yellow plastic or different coloured tags on their wings. So when people saw them in Scotland, they were able to tell us what the colour of the tags were, the wing tags, at that time. And even now, there was no one else wing tagging golden eagles in Ireland or Britain. So we knew that some of our birds from Glenveagh had gone over. Some of them have come back. You think back far enough, several hundred years, golden eagles from Antrim probably went over to as far as Rathlin and then over to Islay and then over to Scotland. So there would have been a natural linkage between the populations in the northern part of Ireland and the southwestern part of Scotland. When we started, Ireland had a very small variety or number of species, native species of birds of prey, by far the lowest number of birds of prey in Europe. We were restored three different species, the red kites, the white-tailed eagles and the golden eagles. We are looking at a couple of other species, osprey and crane, or some people call it the Eurasian crane in particular. We're interested in things like corn bunting. There's a bit of a debate whether black grouse was a native species or not. I imagine it was, though the evidence is still debatable. So osprey and Eurasian cranes could be restored. They're native birds that have become extinct. We think they'd be a great addition to the fauna and the wildlife and the nature of this island. Cranes have been reintroduced into Somerset, and eventually those birds may spread over to Ireland. But we ask ourselves, well, should we be restoring species that we believe was very important in our ancient culture? It was curious when we brought in both the golden eagle and the white-tailed sea eagle reintroduction, we looked at local place names in different parts of the country. Well, that would give you a clue to where those birds were, even though it was several hundred years ago, or maybe more recently in terms of the eagles. But their place names, their footprint would still be in the local culture, and the place names would have recognised that these birds or trees or other aspects of the environment would be associated with different townlands or mountain names. For such a distinctive bird as the crane, and a bird that sometimes can flock in 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 or more flocks, we expected to find an awful lot of crane place names. And in the official interpretation of a lot of place names, they were kind of lacking. Now, there is a debate, and it's probably an ongoing debate, in the 1840s, when a lot of these townland names were interpreted and translated, the word Cor was said to mean a round hill or a variety of other landscape features. But there was a recognition at the time that it wasn't quite understood what Cor meant. So it's my firm opinion that Cor, C-O-R, in place names is largely related to the extinct crane or Eurasian crane. Some of the references to cranes probably in the recent era are very muddied or masked. People have spoken about the crane bag. They don't quite understand its significance. It has a mythical importance. Whoever held the crane bag in Irish myth had special powers. Finn McCool had the crane bag in his possession for a period of time that helped him rule Ireland in myth.
The crane bag is an object?
It seems to be a holder. In Irish, they call it Cor Bullog. It's debated. You know, there was an academic journal in the 70s and 80s, and it seemed to be a compendium of wisdom, or it has that mysterious, mythical aspect to it. No one knows exactly what the crane bag is. The story says that it was made from the skin of a woman who had been turned into a crane, Aoife. But I think there's probably more importance than that.
Going back to the reintroduction of species to Ireland, there's sometimes a bit of an aversion to maybe the bigger animals. Like, I'm sure the eagles faced some questioning, and then wolves, of course, being another big one. Is it maybe a similar kind of aversion to these myths, and the same way that these animals, people kind of think of them as being maybe mythological and therefore being a bit threatening?
It could be, yeah. some people in Donegal were nervous at the start of the programme that the golden eagles might interfere with their livestock. I was asked several times about what were the possibilities of eagles attacking young infants and babies. And there were genuine questions. Going back to the cranes or the wolf or the lynx or the bear, these big animals, they can be deemed to be threatening in a lot of cultures, maybe more so in the East. In India and China, they talk about the heavenly crane, the magical crane, the bountiful crane. You know, you're lucky if you're in the shadow of a crane. This huge reverence, and I suspect that some era there may have been that same reverence and association with nature here. But it's curious to know how attitudes wax and wane, and I'd like to think that the attitude to nature in Ireland is improving at the moment. The crane was probably the fourth most common bird species found in archaeological excavations in Ireland. In Britain, it's probably the second most common bird name and place names. And it just has a lot of cultural and historical references that I think we have overlooked. And part of that reason may be because it was so important to the beliefs and the spiritual opinions of people in a pre-Christian era. We're sometimes a little bit reluctant to talk about the animist era before humanists and Christianity, but surely there was a certain amount of wisdom and intelligence for those communities that built the likes of Newgrange, for example. I've asked a lot of people, well, how come cranes became extinct before the wolf? There must have been plenty of wetland habitat. Was it disease? Did they catch avian flu? Was there a deliberate aim to drive them out, shoot them, trap them, poison them? It is a curiosity as to why the cranes became extinct. And they became extinct all across Ireland, Scotland and England about the same time. It's very strange to think that a species that was once so common was driven totally to extinction. We don't know the answer. I have been looking at cranes and asking individuals about cranes and tentative links with our ancient past and our language and maybe some of our cultural attributes. I wonder whether in an era when people might have had a favourite animal, a totem animal, very often we hear about it in mythology in Egypt or Mesopotamia or Greece or maybe even Rome, that they follow big aggressive predatory animals. And I think that the fact that the crane was a sociable animal, cooperative animal, I think that could have psychologically, I've asked people who are qualified, I'm not, could your totem animal have an impact on your society and your mindset? And I think that the people who followed a cooperative, sociable, flocking and somewhat caring animal, because they do look after weaker members of the flock, I think that could have had an impact on early societies and early outlooks. I think there are a number of other benefits from associating and watching cranes as well. Personally, I'm very confident that there was a strong link with cranes in the distant past that has largely gone uncovered. So I looked at aspects of archaeology, of language, of knowledge in general, and also of belief systems, early belief systems, before the kind of world religions we know today. So, for example, if people followed crane flocks in some form of spiritual belief, they may have noticed that they would have often come to very rich grasslands full of starch, and at some stage humans started to eat the grasses. Archaeologists might say if humans eat grass seed, they won't actually get the nutrition. They have to slightly heat them before they make flour and get the nutrition. But you know, maybe there was a lot of the areas where the earliest farming started in the world are associated with crane flocks. And maybe it's a coincidence, maybe it's not a coincidence. Cranes are good for warning that other predators are coming. I think even in Ukraine and Poland in the 1930s, even people were keeping cranes almost as guard dogs. So they would tell that maybe there was a wolf coming, maybe that there was something happening to livestock. If you were living in the dry steppe, maybe in Turkey, or if you're moving through an environment when people were still nomadic and you're looking for fresh water, the cranes will fly to water outside of the breeding season. They will fly to water at night time, and they'll fly from water in the morning time because they like to stand or roost or sleep standing up in the water at night time. So if you see cranes overhead and where they're flying, that can help you in a landscape that you're not familiar with and you don't have maps, if you think of that era. We know what the humanist era, the whole attitude was, we're in charge of the planet. You're my subject, I'm the object, I'm the subject, you're the object. And then the physical became much more important. If you go back far enough, it could be that we've overlooked a lot of intelligence and wisdom and custom and tradition that didn't suit the norms of the day in the 3rd, 4th or 5th century. We're here in Glenveagh, we're very close to Gartan. In 2021, there's the 1500th anniversary of Niamh Colum Kille, St. Colum Kill, very important early Irish Christian. He was known to say his mass or service in a pre-Christian era on Iona with two cranes on his altar. And you might say, oh, that's cute. Maybe it's a bit more than cute. Maybe there's a reason, there's a linkage of his early generous spirituality that might have had connections with the cooperative, vegetarian, intelligent crane ideas, whatever they were, as people started to think about their own lives. You know, you're a pretty intelligent animal if you can get up in the winter time and move to a warm place. Yeah, that sounds a bit facetious, but I don't think we think enough about where we come from and the landscape we are living in. And we have one set of storylines that have largely been penned in an era since the 7th, 8th and 9th century onwards. And let's be honest, that era was dominated by maybe Roman Christianity in comparison to early Christianity or other beliefs. So maybe we should look under the rock a little bit and ask a few more pointed questions.
Lorcan O'Toole there, and Áine Gallagher was the reporter. If you'd like to get a copy of Lorcan's book, Core Scale, Crane Notions, you can contact him via the Golden Eagle Trust Facebook page. And next on the Culture File Weekly, the forgotten political power of circus, that stuff that happens up there in the rigging. Aerialist Emily even creates theatre shows from her soaring skills, blending choreography, performance art and circus into a theatrical language that's all her own. Culture File's Louis Scully went to visit Even's Aerial Centre in Cabra, Dublin.
My name is Emily Even, and I'm an aerialist, visual artist, designer. It's kind of hard to say exactly what I am, but my, I suppose, expertise lies in aerial dancing and experimental circus in Ireland. Aerial dance comes from circus arts. Most people think of the flying trapeze, the swinging trapeze, that kind of thing. But it has evolved to be more like a dance. So there's the aerial hoop, the aerial silks, aerial rope, and then you have lots of custom designed apparatus that people dance with as well. So it involves rigging from the ceiling, usually, and flying in the air, basically. So Creation Aerial is a small aerial space in Cabra West. I've been teaching aerial here. We run recreational classes, and then more full-time, it's an artist resource space. So we have a number of professional aerialists and other physical artists who work here daily. And it's like a collective, I suppose. The last 2 years was very much focused on more artistic work. And then next year, we're going to really be developing the educational facilities and the artist resource facilities here. When you enter this building, it's extremely obscure. You're like, am I in the right place? There's like a lot of mechanical things happening, and it's a little weird looking. And then you come in here, and it's like, wow! Very feminine, strange little warehouse space. In terms of training, it's an extremely physical discipline. It's one of the things that attracted me to it. It has a mixture between physicality and intelligence and creativity, because it's very logical work as well as physical work, and obviously there's the creative performative element and musical elements to it as well. There's something about the tactile nature of aerial that I just love, and I think that that extends into the work that I'm making as well. It's very tactile, it's very, you know, the detail of the physical, both the body and the material, is really, really attractive to me. The aerial fabric that we use is industrial length underwear fabric. So like, I'm really interested in the anthropological nature of the objects that we use. So we have rope, we have steel. Those two things in themselves are extremely interesting materials. Like, the history of those things in relation even to the evolution of circus is so fascinating. So I kind of arrived at thinking about aerial as this thing that was intrinsically linked to industrial technology. So you have circus springing up alongside kind of industrial revolution. So the circus has happened as a result of needing to create entertainment for the workers. It was an entrepreneurial act.
But then, yes, you can start to move into the fabric now.
So Sorry Gold is the first part of a twin production project on civilization and nature. So Sorry Gold is kind of the civilization part of that. So we're taking this idea that aerial dance is the dance of industrial technology and imagining a biological or a biotechnological art form, a biotechnological dance.
I quite like all the dancing happening in that first part, actually.
I don't want to be polemic in my work. I feel like a lot of the artwork, what I'm observing is a push towards politicizing work and a polemic within work. And I'm trying to process my own thinking around the environment, around this moment in time. But I feel like I'm trying my best to use the work to understand that a little better without making any declarations.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you remember what I was saying?
Emily Even there talking to Louise Scully in her show Mother of Pearl is at the Project Arts Centre Dublin from the 6th to the 9th of November. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more blue sky dancing next Friday at 7. Till then, bye now.